This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher on VSiN, the sports betting network.
All right, Sharp Money coming at you for the next 3 hours on this Wednesday, July 31st. I'm Joe Serrallo, still filling in for Patrick Maher all week long, alongside Dustin Sweetelson. And Dustin, I'd love to exchange pleasantries and ask how you're doing. I mean, you know, I really do care. I want you to know I care about how you're doing. But I care more about the bet you have for a game that's tipping off in what, like any minute now? So let's dive right into it, my man.
Yeah, look, I'll be honest with you, Joe. I actually don't care how you're doing, so this is right up my alley. So we're kind of on the same page at the moment. So,
right, let's skip the BS.
We've got Olympic basketball set to tip off here momentarily, and we do have some line movement in the last, like, 12 hours. So yesterday, USA was laying 29.5 against South Sudan. Right now, it looks like we're 28.5, so a one-point move there. People all over catching the points in South Sudan, and why wouldn't they, right? We saw an exhibition match a couple weeks ago where South Sudan gave America a run for their money, but the game didn't count. So I think this is a fascinating contest, obviously, because of the way that shook out. America making some adjustments. Obviously, no Tatum in game one of the Olympics. Well, Joel Embiid's minutes were limited. But the U.S. is the favorite to win the gold for a reason. They should win Group C against Serbia in game one here. They shot 62.3% from the field. They were really good. Devin Booker got hot. Kevin Durant off the bench dropped 23. LeBron, when it was needed to, he added 21, 9, and 7. So I guess the few questions we have on their end is how much Tatum do we see? Will we see Embiid a little bit more as he was pulled and kind of useless in the style of basketball that U.S. wants to play here in the Olympics? And then for South Sudan, just to set the scene, they beat Puerto Rico as underdogs on Sunday. They led the U.S., as I mentioned, in an exhibition until LeBron took over in the final minutes. The guy to watch for them is Carleek Jones. He had a triple-double in that exhibition matchup against the U.S., led the way 19-7-6 against Puerto Rico. He played 37 minutes. No other player for that team played over 30. And when I looked at this team, there was another name I recognized, Joe. The name, Wenyen Gabriel. And he's not a household name. I totally understand that. But he had 9 rebounds in 21 minutes against Puerto Rico. He had 6 rebounds in 19 minutes in the exhibition against the U.S. I think if they have any shot today of hanging again with the Americans, he's going to have to be on the glass as one of the few NBA players they have. He played 150 games in the NBA. He's a 6'9 forward out of Kentucky. So we're going to go Wenyen Gabriel over 6.5 rebounds.
I like the play a lot, man. Look, you know, I'm not going to sit here and lie and say I've been capping the South Sudan team religiously or extensively, but you have to imagine 19 minutes in the exhibition. Now that there's actually something on the line here, you have to imagine his minutes are going to go up. And if he grabs 6 and 19, I could absolutely see him going over that 6.5 mark today. I like the play. You know, Dustin, it's funny. When that exhibition game was being played, I was actually at Circa. I was wrapping up my week there, All-Star Week. I was on 6 straight days with VSiN, so I came into Vegas for the occasion, and naturally my girl was out shopping, so I was just sitting in the book watching games, waiting for her to wrap up so we could, oh yeah, with my credit card. So I was waiting at the book watching games so we could hit the road, and that game happened to be on. I gotta say, the reaction, there was a group, Dustin, of about a dozen dudes in like the bottom left corner. And there were these 3 younger guys behind them rooting for South Sudan, which honestly, exhibition game, major upset, 40-point dog. I was kind of rooting for South Sudan too in that one. Like there was no medal on the line, you know, no pride. It was an exhibition, right? And these 3 guys were rooting for South Sudan. And then when LeBron, you know, puts the finger roll in at the end there to put the U.S. up ultimately for good, these like 12 guys, and they were exactly like the kind of guys you'd envision. I'm just going to leave it at that. Like this, the guys you'd envision based on their look. Just turn around and like start USA, USA, like puffing their chest out, you know, trying to take the stilts out so they could be 6'1". It was doing that over an exhibition. I don't know, Dustin, maybe I'm wired a little differently as someone who was an athlete who played. When you're a 40-point favorite, there is no reason to lose your you-know-what because of a 1-point win. I don't know if I'm in the minority there, but that win was not something to be proud of. to me, Dustin.
See, I'll come back a little bit the other way, but still kind of agreeing. I think the way the American team treated that game was the way you're supposed to treat it. Let's get through it. Let's go through the motions. Let's figure out some of our sets. Let's not show too much. And in the end, we know if we're in trouble, we know if we turn it on, they're not hanging with us. So wait until we have to use it before having to use it, right? Just sit there, sit back, let them hit you with their best shot. It's a big game for them, despite it not counting. They want to prove themselves. And for the Americans, it's just like, look, we'll figure it out when we have to figure it out. I think that was the correct approach. But to celebrate the win was a little bit odd. I also thought there was a massive overreaction to that. And I think in the world we live in here in betting, there's ways to capitalize on the overreaction. And I do believe if I was going to back this game from a spread perspective, I would lay it with the U.S. because I do think the U.S. Ooh. Was just going through it there. I know it's a big number. I know it was proven otherwise last time, but this counts now. And they know what everyone's saying about them, and I think they want to send a message on their way to a gold.
That's interesting because I'm staying away here. I'm not going to say, well, oh, look, you know, South Sudan lost by one last time. So, yeah, I'm taking the 28.5 because I could see the U.S. winning by 35. But I could also see this U.S. team being up 30 late and totally taking their foot off the pedal here and South Sudan losing by 18, I don't know, 20. So this one, it's just too big of a number for me to touch. You want me to touch a 28.5 point number? Talk to me in November when college hoops are back. Then I will be hammering some 28.5 point numbers.
Well, we're a couple minutes in. I only see one rebound for the South Sudanese, and it's Wenyen Gabriel. Just
Boom.
Need six more.
Thing.
Six more, and we're good.
That is a beautiful thing. So Dustin Sweetelson, noted Serbia lover, if you were watching the show yesterday, and Joe Serralo, noted South Sudan lover. It's just, you know, man, I will say, it's hard to feel pride in the Olympics when you're running out the best of the best in the NBA. You know, I do think that there is an element that's lost by having pros in the Olympics. If you had, you know, our best college basketball players, right, an amateur team, I think it would be a lot more exciting. Yeah. And I'd be locked into these games, you know, rooting for an 18-year-old who hasn't gone pro yet, or a 17, you know,
or limits.
Watching LeBron James. I love LeBron James. Don't get me. I mean, I know he's a polarizing figure. I absolutely love LeBron James. But watching him out there against South Sudan doesn't do anything for me. It doesn't excite me in any way whatsoever because it's like, all right, cool. We've got, you know, everything to lose and nothing to gain because anything beneath the gold medal is an utter disappointment.
Yeah, I think limits would be good, right? Like maybe no more than half your roster can be NBA players. So if it's like 13, 14 guys, six or seven NBA, six or seven from the collegiate ranks, right? Who knows what ends up on that team? And all of a sudden it's like, there's also an element of me where I'm happy there are no New York Knicks on this team, right? I'm happy Jalen Brunson was snubbed.
For injury? Because I'm mad Brunson. Okay, because I'm mad Brunson was snubbed.
This
I thought Brunson deserved it.
It doesn't matter. You get paid millions of dollars to play the game. I understand wanting a gold. I understand the pride. I totally get that. But to risk all of that when you're not judged. Carmelo Anthony has a million gold medals. He's one of the great international players of all time. All people talk about is how he didn't get a ring playing in the NBA.
Yep.
So you may like this for your legacy, but as a fan, I do not want my guys wasting their energy on this. Rest up, relax in the offseason. Let's go finish the job next year.
I got to say, man, I love Carmelo Anthony. Jalen Brunson may have already passed
him. Oh, no, he stop. Wenyen Gabriel, three rebounds. we're just getting started. It's not even a conversation. And I loved Melo. I think actually Melo, there's been overreaction. That might be the theme of the day. An overreaction to how things played out at the end in his tenure in New York. I actually think people are too hard on him and don't appreciate what he was able to do. I mean, we actually take for granted that the guy was just instant buckets. You fed him the ball in the post. He hit you with a baseline jumper, got to the rim, could hit key threes. I think we've actually overreacted because of the lack of a championship that people now don't properly appreciate Carmelo Anthony as a player.
I agree with you 1,000%. I think that people are too hard on Melo, but I also don't think it's an overreaction to say that Jalen Brunson
I agree.
Has already cemented his legacy as a better all-time Knick than Carmelo Anthony. If he's not already, in your opinion, give it a year or two, and he undoubtedly will be. But yeah, I mean, look, you have to remember what Melo was working with, right? I mean, those teams, when they lost to Indiana, Amari Stoudemire was hardly a factor that season. He was injured. If we really got to see a full season, because I think the only time that the three guys were healthy together, Melo, Stoudemire, and Tyson Chandler, was, I believe, the shortened season with the contract holdout and the strike. If we got to see Amare and Melo compete at full health together, there was, I mean, it was hard to find a better duo outside of what the Miami Heat had working in the entire NBA.
No, but you're also right, though. Jalen Brunson is in – Patrick Ewing's my guy. Like, for if I ever got dogs, I would get three dogs. They would be named Ewing, Starks, and Oakley. Like, already planned out. I wouldn't get one dog.
Oakley
I'd get three.
Would be the pit bull, right?
Yeah, the psycho dog. Ewing, Starks, and Oakley. And maybe we get, like, a cat, name it Mason. I don't know. But that Patrick Ewing is my guy through and through. Jalen Brunson is very, very close to passing Patrick Ewing for me for all-time greatest Nick in my lifetime.
Yeah, it's a very reasonable pass. I mean, you know, look, none of those guys could get it done, get what Clyde and Willis Reed got done. We'll see if Brunson can lead the way and do that for the Knicks. Dustin, we've got a great show lined up the rest of the 3 hours. Incredible guest lineup. Let's throw that up on the screen. My guy, Lijay Duzable, joining the show. We're going to talk about his Jets. Chris Ruffalo, John Bowman, Cole Thompson as well. Bowman coming up soon. We're going to handicap a jam-packed and, by the way, really nicely spread out MLB slate today. Games from 9 a.m. all the way up until the late slate with the Giants and A's. Hint, hint, I might have a play in the battle by the Bay. Dustin, did you have any morning action? I'm 1-1 so far. I lost Taj Bradley under 1.5 earned, but I hit the O's first five run line. Laid a little too much juice there, but got a winner.
I didn't touch the baseball. I did lose on Jokic. I had over 20.5 points. He almost had a triple-double, but rebounds were the play, not the points against the Puerto Ricans.
You know, Serbians, Puerto Ricans, the Serbians are always going to be way bigger. Just how it works out. A lot of show left. Sharp money right here on VSiN. Don't go anywhere. We are releasing our VSiN College Football Betting Guide tomorrow. This guide is your ultimate resource for the upcoming college football season, including previews of all 134 teams, a preseason top 25, and more. So sign up before the end of July and receive both the college football and NFL betting guides, plus full VSiN Pro access to our daily pro picks, 24/7 video, and more for just $1.75. Or you can sign up monthly and get your first 30 days for only $19 to see everything VSiN has to up your betting game. Don't miss out on these preseason deals. Visit VSiN.com/subscribe to sign up today. That's VSiN.com/subscribe. As we roll along here on Sharp Money this Wednesday, July 31st, Joe Cirillo here in for Patty Maher, Dustin Sweetelson on the other side, live from the D, my man. And I alluded to it before the break at the end of the last segment, a really nicely spaced out MLB schedule today. You know, this is a rarity because we criticize Manfred a lot. They seem to drop the ball. It's like one Saturday, you'll have 12 games starting at 9 a.m. or 10 a.m. Pacific. And then the next Saturday, there won't be a game until, you know, 4 p.m. Eastern. And there's just no consistency when you have opportunities. I would say probably 4 days a week with the travel days, Wednesday, Thursday, to really space out some games. And today, Dustin, I think is a beautiful example of that being well done. Games from 9 a.m. until, you know, 7 p.m. or 6:40 p.m. local Pacific time. It's this is how baseball should be. Just like 3 to 4 games teeing off every couple of hours.
Yeah, it's not so different like in NFL season where I hate how bottom heavy the schedule is at the start of the day. When it comes to the NFL games, and it lightens up in the afternoon, and then obviously one standalone game at night. Like, this schedule kind of reminds me of that today. We had a bunch of morning games. We've got a few trickling in the afternoon, and then a couple of night games or four night games. So it's like, I prefer this because I think it's easier to focus. I think there's an overwhelming factor with baseball when everyone goes off at like 7 Eastern or 7 o'clock local time. So you're looking at like 7 or 8 games in one window, 4 or 5 in another window. It just becomes too hard to monitor. With this, you can kind of stop, take a breath, and go, okay, I like this one, I don't like this one, and move on to the next. Like, just treat it in chunks of the day to focus in on.
Absolutely. You know, like I fired away. I zoned in on the early games when I was up, made my coffee this morning, and I fired away on Taj Bradley, and the Orioles first five. And then, you know, I kind of let those play out a little bit. I mean, I put the Chris Sale strikeout prop in probably 10 minutes before game time. I didn't feel rushed like I had to, you know, rush through my handicapping, not do as good of a job as I would have liked, and fire away on everything, you know, all at the same time. So that was a nice way to go about my handicapping. It's funny you mention it with football, because I couldn't agree with you more. There is nothing worse than, I mean, you've got what, Thursday, Sunday night, Monday night. So that's 13 games left. There is nothing worse than when you have 10 early games and only three in that afternoon slot.
And in the afternoon slot, there's always one atrocious one that you don't even want red zone to go to.
Right, like Cardinals Raiders or something like that.
I was going to say Cardinals Panthers.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. I was just thinking West Coast. But yeah, it's like, you know, there's no reason it shouldn't be 8-5. To go like 10-3 is just absolute overload. And then, you know, you're sitting at the sports bar and one or two aren't even on a screen and your head's bouncing around like you got something wrong with you. You know, it's it's not fun when they can't do the scheduling right. You think it's really something that's so simple and so easy to get right.
We're just looking for a little balance. That's all. Just a little bit of balance. It doesn't have to be completely, but just slightly balanced.
So we've got two more baseball games trickling in the next 50 minutes. In 20 minutes, we've got the D-backs playing host to the Nationals. And then the Mariners wrap up a series in Fenway with the Red Sox at 1:10 Pacific time, 4:10 Eastern. Let's start with that Nationals D-backs game. Mackenzie Gore, most likely, I would say the guy that people consider the ace of the Nationals, even though he's been struggling a bit lately. He's still got great stuff. Young kid coming in from the left side with some velo. He's going up against Zach Gallen, the presumed ace of Arizona, who has really struggled lately. D-backs here, a pretty good size favorite, laying $1.75 on the money line. What was that score last night, Dustin? 17-0. They teed off against Paddy Corbin, who gave up 9 in the first two innings and was left in there to go out for the third and give up another one. That kind of surprised me. The Nationals, I just think, have had it with Patrick Corbin at this point. They're like, hey, you made your bet, go lay in it.
Yeah, also, like, let's not burn our bullpen. We're already out of it because of you. You might as well reach a certain number of pitchers so we don't have to waste two more guys after you, because there is another day to live for, which is today. Yeah, our over 4.5 team total on the D-backs barely got there last night. A bit of a sweat there early on in that one. Look, we're going to go back to the well here. We're not reinventing the wheel. When it comes to left-handed pitching, these Diamondbacks have a lot of lefty killers, most notably Ketel Marte. He's a guy who went over his total bases last night. He's someone I'd always look at whenever he's facing a southpaw. And you mentioned it, Mackenzie Gore, while he has a lot of upside, big key part of that Juan Soto trade from San Diego, he hasn't been great on the road. He hasn't been good of late. His last three road starts, he's got a 9.51 ERA. And Corbin last night, another lefty, only lasted three innings, 13 hits, 10 earned. When you look back at what this Arizona team has done offensively against lefties, it's been pretty remarkable of late. So on Monday, they faced Mitchell Parker, also a lefty. They got him for two runs, but remember, Kyle Finnegan, the closer, allowed 5 in the ninth. He's also a lefty, so that's 7 off of left-handed pitching. Last Saturday against Marco Gonzalez of Pittsburgh, they tagged him, 4 earned runs. They scored 9 in that game. And you look at Arizona hitters lifetime against Mackenzie Gore, 342 average, 806 OPS. They see him well. I would love to do something with the Diamondbacks and back them on the first 5, but I can't get there with Zach Gallen. He's got a 6 ERA in July. He's coming off 3 earned and 6 innings against Pittsburgh on Friday. And when you look at his season as a whole, velocity was down to start the year. Things picked back up in that regard, but the results have not been consistent. I'm very concerned about his health, and because of that, concerned about the Diamondbacks long-term this season. Over team total 4.5 on Arizona today.
Yeah, Zach Gallen's a guy too, Dustin, who has been so consistent at home over the past two seasons, 2022 and 2023, a combined 2.48 home ERA. He has been sensational at Chase Field, which is, I would say, one of the top three hitters' ballparks in baseball. I mean, not that the dimensions are anything like Yankee Stadium, but with that dry air out there in the desert in Phoenix, I mean, the ball just absolutely flies. Also, I've talked to some guys who were, you know, major league hitters, and they say that the visibility at Chase Field, one of the easiest parks, if not the easiest, to see the ball coming out of the opposing pitcher's hand. But Gallen this year, even though his home and away splits are better, leaning towards the home angle, just a 3.5 ERA at home, as opposed to, like I said, a two-season sample size of 2.5. I want to back Gallen. This was a guy who last year, every time he was on the bump, I would back him. I'd find some way. Outs recorded, I loved, because he was a workhorse last year going deep. earned runs at times if the K prop wasn't something I liked. I would just always find a way to back him. And now that's becoming increasingly more difficult this season. You said it. His velo's down. He already had a stint on the IL. It just feels like something is up. He's not himself. And he really wasn't even himself in the postseason last year, right? I said Merrill Kelly was the ace of that staff in the postseason. Brandon Pfaadt, who had a terrible rookie season in the regular season, was great in the playoffs. Guy showed onions in that series against Philadelphia. I can't find a full game angle to back Gallen. One thing that's intriguing me, and I'm curious your thought on it, I know it's more of a stay away for you, but the Nerfy. You only have to lay $1.15. Mackenzie Gore usually comes out hot. He's pitched to the Nerfy in 17 out of 20 this season. Zach Gallen's done so in 13 out of 16. Is this something, no Christian Walker atop the D-backs lineup? Would this intrigue you?
That's interesting. I have concerns because the reason I'm backing Arizona is the way they hit lefties. Now, when they get their runs, I don't know. Concerned about Gore on the road as well playing a role in that. I'm not a big Yerfy-Nerfy guy. I acquiesce to you and Jared Smith, the father of first innings, when it comes to these things. I do want to ask you about Arizona big picture. They are a half game out of the wild card. They're minus 110 at DraftKings to make the playoffs. Like, I think maybe we're underselling win-loss. They're six games over 500, but, like, I have no feel that this team's going to do something. However, last year I also had an 80-1 ticket on them to win the World Series, and they got there.
Wow. Yeah, so we actually really haven't talked about this. You know, when I was doing Sharp Money with Dave Ross and Mike Somich the week of the All-Star game, we dove into this a lot. So I didn't want to sound redundant, but I'm realizing this is the first time you're hearing of this. I took the D-backs plus $1.45 at the All-Star break to make the playoffs. I love Arizona as a playoff team. So at minus 110, I wouldn't do that. I also took a preseason. I have a preseason ticket on them. I have them over 83.5 wins on the year. I love this Diamondbacks team, and here's why. We talk about Zach Gallen's struggles. That rotation's only going to get better. Merrill Kelly is coming back. Eduardo Rodriguez, E-Rod, who hasn't even laced up for them yet, he's coming back off the IL. You talk about trade deadline acquisitions. That's going to be like two of the waiver deadline. Remember the old August 31st deadline? It's going to be two late season acquisitions to their rotation. Ryan Nelson has had a great month of July. He pitched, gave him seven shutty last night. Brandon Pfaadt has turned it around. The D-backs pitching is going to get better. And the lineup, they've showed us that they can mash. I love Arizona. They are making the playoffs. When we come back, some handicapping on today's slate. John Bowman joining the show. Guys, don't go anywhere. You're locked into Sharp Money. Sharp Money rolling along on this Wednesday afternoon. Joe Cirillo here in for Patrick Maher alongside Dustin Sweetelson. And we're going to hit the progressive guest line here, Dustin, because we've got a lot of baseball on the slate to talk about today. So who better to bring in and talk about it, handicap some games, discuss yesterday's trade deadline, than former Blue Jays scout, current MLB handicapper, John Bowman. John, how you doing, man?
I'm good, man. Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. We appreciate you making the time. And I want to start right there with that former club, of course, of yours, the Toronto Blue Jays, and get your reaction to what they did yesterday. I think a lot of people thought Vladdy would be on the move. He ultimately was not dealt. Bichette also remaining a Blue Jay. What do you think of how Toronto handled that deadline? Obviously, you know, they're out on this season, but moving forward, not closing the door to success. Do you like it, or do you think that they should have begun a full-scale rebuild?
I love it. I think they made the perfect moves. I don't think they should have moved Vladdy. I don't think they should have moved Bo. But I do think they had a lot of pieces to move, especially Yusei Kikuchi, who got a massive return. Joey Loperfido, Jake Bloss, and another player. A couple of the Astros' top prospects there. He actually commanded a little bit more than some of the other starting pitchers on the market. So Ross Atkins did very well, in my opinion. I don't think you want to move on from a guy like Vladdy. He's a generational player. You've got to give him his contract and make him a cornerstone for the future. Bo Bichette, his value right now, he's having a terrible season. His value's at an all-time low. So you don't really want to sell a guy, especially when he's hurt, when his value's at an all-time low. You kind of just want to wait, have him get back next year, especially if you think he can contribute. So I love what the Blue Jays did.
Yeah, that Kikuchi deal was crazy. I couldn't believe how much they got in return. They also dealt Justin Turner to Seattle a couple days ago, John. When you look at the Mariners right now, first place in the AL West, still plus 115 over at DraftKings to win that division. They needed offense. They brought in maybe not the sexiest names at this point in their career, but Justin Turner, a little bit older, but a veteran who's won a World Series. Randy Arozarena, who's popped in the playoffs before. What do you think of the moves the Mariners made to add those two to that lineup?
I really like what the Mariners did. I don't think with their type of team, you can really go overboard and say overpay for example, like a Vladdy, you know, kind of give away your whole farm for a guy like him, because the Mariners needed so much help. You know, you can't necessarily just plug one guy into that lineup and everything will be fixed. They needed a lot of options. So I love what they did with that pitching. They're going to be able to contend until the very end, and their bats are starting to heat up a bit. They'll get Julio Rodriguez and JP Crawford off the IL soon, and that lineup will be a little bit deep. And honestly, they just have to be good enough to keep their pitching in it. So I like what the Mariners did as well.
Yeah, I want to stick in that AL East and look at a rival of the Blue Jays and the Baltimore Orioles and what they did at the deadline. I would say it's an interesting deadline, to say the least, for Baltimore. Now, you can look at the moves that they made and adding Rodgers and Eflin to the rotation. Certainly shored up from where it's been because they've had so many injuries, but they really failed to get that solidified number two behind Corbin Burns. Now they're going to have to rely on Grayson Rodriguez. They gave up a bat who's been a mainstay in Baltimore and Austin Hayes to try to shore up an inconsistent bullpen. I see a lot of pros, but also a lot of cons to what the Orioles did. What's your take on Baltimore's deadline? I'm personally not as quick to crown them a winner like most.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think they made some good moves and some or not so good moves that they didn't make. But added Eflin, added Rodgers to that rotation. I don't love trading Connor Norby for Rodgers. I mean, Rodgers, you have the control, but Norby is one of their top prospects. Kind of would have expected them to be in on like a Tarik Skubal, Garrett Crochet, maybe more so. But we heard that bombshell of a story come out about Crochet not going to pitch in the playoffs, which kind of defeats the purpose of trading for him. So not terribly surprised the Orioles didn't make any moves. My guess is, especially for like a Tarik Skubal, they were being asked about Jackson Holliday, one of their top prospects. And I don't think they wanted to move him, frankly. So they did a lot of retooling instead of kind of making that big move. And if you look at it, they called up Jackson Holliday back to the big league team. And that's kind of a move if you look at it. You know, you don't necessarily trade for him, but you bring him up to the big league team. And hopefully he's kind of what you'd expect now. So the Orioles did a lot of retooling. I think that they're a better team, but definitely a little surprised that they didn't make that big move.
I mean, how surprised are you at the market for starting pitchers this deadline? It just felt like everyone had to gross overpay when Trevor Rodgers, who I think is a very serviceable four at his absolute peak a few years ago, a three, but you have to give up not one but two prospects. I was shocked Tanner Scott or someone else wasn't coming back in that deal for Baltimore. I think that's why we didn't see the bigger pitchers on the move. When you have to pay that big of a price for those guys, it feels like an insane ask for these teams. Also on top of that, just going forward, Baltimore's rotation, John. Like, I get it. Eflin's not sexy, but he's serviceable. Rodgers, less sexy, a little less serviceable, but still a solid guy there in the back end. Do you think that got enough for them to set them up in the playoffs?
Yeah, and I mean, you said it. The market was absolutely insane. Some of the returns that we were seeing for these players is something that, honestly, I didn't even imagine. I tweeted out the other day, if I were a GM for one of these teams that's contending, I honestly might think about just not doing anything because the market was so insane. I think that's also why we saw the Orioles kind of retool, add guys like Eflin and Rodgers, maybe who they think, you know, they can tweak his arsenal a bit, have him throw certain pitches more and kind of fix him in a way. Because the Orioles, the other thing about the Orioles is if you have the farm system that they have, you have all those top prospects, you're going to get asked about them every single time somebody wants to trade with you. You know, you can't necessarily have that 9th, 10th, 11th prospect that you offer and keep all of your top guys. Every single team is going to ask about the same guys. So I think it just shows, like I said, how much they value their prospects. And yeah, Eflin and Rodgers, great pieces to that rotation. Eflin, you know, was probably a one last year. He could be two, three if he's performing at his best. Trevor Rodgers is a good 4-5 guy. He can give them some good innings. So I do think that they did a good job, and I do think they'll be able to compete. But it'll be all about their bats in the playoffs and that bullpen.
Now, John, when you look at the cost of some of these guys yesterday, obviously the focus and attention has been on starting pitching, but even a rental out of the bullpen. Tanner Scott getting the Marlins 4 prospects from San Diego. 2 of those guys, the Padres' top 4 prospects. Kind of absurd, especially when you look at the fact that he has no control and is a rental. Does this move make San Diego a potential World Series contender for you now that their pitching is starting to get healthy on the rotation side of things? Or if not San Diego, who yesterday made a move that you say, okay, I could see them being a legit World Series contender now because of what they did at the deadline?
Yeah, I think the Padres are a great example, to be honest. I mean, they literally sold the farm. You know, that term is kind of thrown around, but they literally did that to get the players that they wanted. And I do think that they're World Series contenders now. I mean, we saw how full that stadium was yesterday on a Tuesday night against the Dodgers. I believe it was the largest crowd that they've ever had at that park. The fans want baseball in San Diego, and they're kind of delivering it. AJ Preller, we know, is known for making lots of deals, wheeling and dealing, trading a lot of guys. It's what he does. So I think that the Padres are all in now. It's kind of what they were going for. It seems like, you know, they want it now. They've been contending for a few years now. They've tasted the National League championship, the NLCS. So I think they're going all in now, and I do think it makes them a World Series contender.
John Bowman with us, former MLB scout, does awesome handicapping at Baseball with Bowman. All the info on his Twitter, at JohnBowman11. So let's handicap a couple games here, John. We've got the Pirates at the Astros, 8-10 on the East Coast. Jake Woodford on the bump for the Buccos, plus $1.80 there. Framber Valdez has been awesome. Lay 218 with him, total set at 8. What are you going to do with this contest?
Yeah, so my favorite play there is the Astros minus 1.5. Framber Valdez has been pitching very well lately. You got Jake Woodford on the other side for the Pirates. He's made a couple starts this season, hasn't really gone more than 4 innings, and hasn't pitched too great. So that means the Pirates' bullpen is going to get a little extended. The Astros have all of their bullpen, everyone in their bullpen available. They're looking to avoid the home sweep. So I think the Astros get it done at home there. I also don't mind a first five minus 0.5 if you want to go that route. It's kind of deciding between the two, but I think the Astros avoid the sweep at home.
Yeah, I like that first five call there, John, especially because with the home team, you could be sacrificing those three outs in the bottom of the ninth. First five, everyone gets 15 outs to work with. Let's shift gears, though, and bring it back to a team that we were just discussing, the Padres. They play host to the Dodgers tonight. Dylan Cease, fresh off a no-no against Clayton Kershaw, second start of the year. How does Cease respond to the no-hitter in D.C. last time out? How do the Padres fare tonight?
Yeah, so I like the Padres on the money line here. My big worry is definitely Dylan Cease coming off the no-hitter. I mean, we've seen a lot of these pitchers come off no-hitters and kind of ride that high and have a little bit of a dud, but he's been pitching so well lately. And we saw the Padres go down 5-0 in the first inning yesterday, and they still came back and won. They're going up against Clayton Kershaw, and if there's a team that's seen Kershaw, it's the Padres. And Kershaw's not going to get terribly deep in the game. He's probably going to pitch 5 innings, which means the Dodgers' bullpen is going to get a little extended. Once again, the Padres have seen those bats, and the Padres seem to be, you know, feeling the momentum from that trade deadline. So I like the Padres on the money line there.
John, incredible stuff. Thank you so much, man. Appreciate the time.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Great stuff. Great stuff.
Give him a follow on Twitter at JohnBowman11. Great handicapping right there. When we come back, from the diamond to the gridiron, time for the 3-point stance. Don't go anywhere. You're locked into Sharp Money. Head over to VSiN.com right now to check out some of our incredible daily articles like Adam Burke's daily MLB write-ups and winners, best bets, betting splits, exclusive articles, and more only on VSiN.com. Don't waste time. Check it out today. And speaking of winners, as we roll along here on Sharp Money with myself, Joe Serallo, in for Patrick Maher alongside my guy, Dustin Swedelson. Dustin, you've got an early winner on this show. Not even a full hour in, man. Tell us about it.
You gotta love a first half cover. Just like, look, I'm gonna sweat regardless at my size, but it's nice when the bet isn't making me sweat. And our
I heard
guy,
it's hot at the D. In all fairness, I heard it's very hot at the D right now.
Yeah. We're in a bit of a weird climate situation up here at Bar Canada. It's the opposite of Canada. But what I would say is Wenyen Gabriel is my favorite player on South Sudan all time. Greatest of all time. We went over 6.5 rebounds. It was available VSiN.com/picks this morning. And he has 7 in the first half against the U.S. Right now, that score 55-36, the good guys on top. That is America at half.
depending on who you ask. Not everyone would share that sentiment. We agree. We feel that way. Not everyone would. So what is that? 19 they're up with. So they still need to outscore him by 10. See, this is why 28.5 points. I don't want to touch it, right? Are they going to be motivated to go out there and outscore him by 10 the rest of the way?
Again, especially when they've got NBA jobs to go back to. You're right. But at the same time, I do think there's a level of a message being sent potentially, like, let the rest of the world know where we're at. We were just messing around for those exhibition games. This is the real USA.
Yeah, let a naysayer know, as they like to say on college game day. Dustin, speaking of game day, let's flip it to football a little bit. Time for the three-point stance, and it wouldn't be a news cycle without talking about Aaron Rodgers and the New York Jets, right? Now, normally, when you're dealing with a veteran, right, someone who Rodgers is, what, 40, 41 years old?
He's a man.
The preseason doesn't matter, right? He's a man. He's 40. Ask Gundy. Mike Gundy, by the way, the gift that keeps on giving. How about what he said a couple weeks ago? When you look at Rodgers coming off an Achilles, normally a preseason wouldn't matter for a guy who's been in this league for upwards of 15, close to 20 years. Coming off an injury like that, though, it might matter. Do you think it's important that Rodgers gets some reps in the preseason?
No, because I think you can simulate most of what you need to in practice, and there's just too much on the line there. They're all in on this year. So whether or not he's ready is kind of irrelevant health. You know what I mean? Like, if he has to go out there and it ends up getting hurt again, not that they would know going in, but it doesn't matter. They're all in on this year. Tyrod Taylor is the backup. And I just think it's irrelevant, the preseason. Let's rest his leg, make sure everything's 100%. Don't risk it until it matters in a real game at real speed. Everything they need to do can be replicated in camp, at practice. I just don't think the preseason matters anymore. It mattered at one point, and it mattered for players deep down the roster to make an impact. But in the end, the actual game, like a player who hasn't been practicing well all week but plays well in a preseason game, they're still at risk of not making that team. The practices hold more water than the games do in the preseason.
That's an interesting take. I don't disagree with it at all, though. I mean, look, preseason football, it doesn't intrigue me one bit. We were just talking about this earlier, how right now you and I are in baseball mode, but most people, most bettors are out there waiting for the preseason. I might not even watch a lick of football until week one actually rolls around. I can't stand preseason football. But let's see what Jets head coach Robert Saleh had to say about Aaron Rodgers and the prospect of playing in the preseason.
We haven't really talked about it. My instinct right now as I stand here is we'll see.
Your instinct is we'll see.
My instinct is no. But
I
want to leave it open that that third game is the one where we're deciding. So he definitely won't play the first two, but the discussion on the third one, we just haven't quite had yet.
It sounds exhausting, man. That sounds exhausting. Being Aaron Rodgers' head coach, just there's always something that you have to talk about that just isn't regular football. And like, you have to have coded messages, because if you say something the way Aaron doesn't like it, you know Aaron then going to go out and talk about it, how he didn't like the tone. Like, there's just always something. Like, I have Aaron Rodgers fatigue. With that said, I'm very high on the Jets this year, Joe.
You know, it pains me to be high on Aaron Rodgers, although, I mean, he's always high on God knows what. But I'm with you, man. I really do like the Jets this year. And it's not even so much because of Rodgers and the offense, although I think Breece Hall is primed for an absolute breakout season. It's more so because of their defense, Dustin. I think that this defense has legitimate number one potential. The pass rush is sensational. I think it's absolutely ferocious up front. And then, of course, pass rush and secondaries always go hand in hand. Well, when you have an incredible lockdown corner like Sauce Gardner back there and a ferocious pass rush to go with it, I mean, his job just gets exponentially easier. So plus, I mean, you look at that schedule after week one, which I'm not taking the Jets to win week one. Aaron Rodgers stinks in San Francisco. I mean, look at what he did there when he was a Packer. They had better records in the they would have to go there for playoff games, and he would just get embarrassed in San Francisco. I'm not taking him week one, but man, that schedule, it's like Cupcake City after that Niners game for the remainder of the first half of the season, all the way up until, I believe, the Houston matchup week nine. I'm high on the Jets as well, but like you said, you know, being the head coach, it's almost like you're Aaron Rodgers' personal PR as opposed to a football coach. And that's got to get exhausting and frustrating when you're in a potential year where, I wouldn't even say potential, a year where you're on the hot seat, like Robert Saleh absolutely is right now.
Yeah, you know, he's on the hot seat. Joe Douglas is on the hot seat, and he has to make sure Aaron Rodgers is happy because who knows? Aaron Rodgers might be running for vice president in a week. We don't know what's going to happen with him. I will say this about the Jets. Like,
not a convention switcheroo for Rodgers and RFK.
But when I look at this roster, the thing I like best, and again, paper doesn't make champions here, but they gave themselves a lot of flexibility on the offensive line where they desperately needed help. And I do think when you look at the talent, it's like a video game. If you could turn injuries off and injuries didn't account for anyone, I think you can make a strong case that this team has the highest upside. I don't think it's crazy for Breece Hall at 15-1, Garrett Wilson at 28-1 to both be in the mix for Offensive Player of the Year simply because Rodgers is back to make them both look and play better. So all across the board, I like them to win the East. I'm going to have like 22-1 on them to win the Super Bowl. I like all the upside here, but again, it's a high-risk, high-reward team. We'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, so many question marks with the Bills and Dolphins. Question marks with the Jets too, but I think fewer than their divisional opponents. Speaking of quarterbacks, there is a QB battle out by you in the desert that to me doesn't make much sense. I am out on Aiden O'Connell. Yeah. I could not be any more out on Aiden O'Connell, but this still seems like a battle between him and Gardner Minshew, who, look, isn't going to win you a Super Bowl, but could get you 9 wins and a wild card spot. That's pretty much his ceiling. I don't think O'Connell has a ceiling that high. I want to know what Antonio Pierce thinks about his QB battle out there in Vegas.
Right, everything. I think it's difficult when we didn't have pads on. There was a lot of things that I'm sure you saw and looked like the defense is winning, but obviously you hope that would stop now with pads on, a little bit more resistant. But it goes back to it. Number one thing is taking care of the ball, putting the team in a position to win. Managing the offense, understanding the operational. You saw some situational stuff there yesterday. I think our guys are doing a good job. Both quarterbacks have really embracing it. But again, I'm just go back to it. Somebody has to just separate from the other.
So you didn't really get a whole lot of opinion from Pierce so far. I mean, somebody has to separate from the other. Yeah, thanks, Antonio. What do you think about that?
I think that's the shocking part, is they paid Gardner Minshew all this money. And doesn't Gardner Minshew feel a lot like Ryan Fitzpatrick? Ryan Fitzpatrick, when he got paid by teams and was expected to succeed and be a QB1, always let you down. But Ryan Fitzpatrick, as the backup, when another quarterback is failing or gets hurt and has to come in, all of a sudden low expectations and he's awesome. That's the vibe I get from Gardner Minshew, which perhaps is why this battle is closer than it should be. Because much like you, there's nothing about Aiden O'Connell's game that says special at the quarterback position.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, Dustin. I'll tell you what, if Gardner Minshew is the quarterback for the Raiders this year, I almost said for Oakland, for the Las Vegas Raiders this year, they're going over 6.5 wins. They might be a second place team in that division because I'm not high on the Chargers. If Aiden O'Connell is the quarterback, it's going to be a disaster in Sin City. Last quarterback battle I want to get to, Jerod Mayo, rookie head coach for the Pats.
Yeah, I don't think we have time for it. It's a little bit of a longer clip. We'll play it later in the show. But
okay.
The New England Patriots, Joe, as a
Let's
team,
talk about it, though. Yeah.
As a team for me, go pull up the Patriots schedule. They are the last winless team. That is the bet to place. It is so abysmal, it feels like we're being baited by the sports books. That's how weak their schedule is to start the year. They do not have a chance the first few weeks of the year. At the Bengals, the Seahawks, at the Jets, at the Niners, versus the Dolphins, versus the Texans, at the Jaguars in London, the Jets again, and then finally at the Titans in week 9. And I have to tell you, I'm a little more bullish on the upside of the Titans than most people. They may not win that one. I don't know when the first win comes.
And those are tough, the Titans and Bears games, because they're both on the road. If they were at home, much more winnable. You have to hope the coaching staff schematically can figure out something to fluster a couple of young quarterbacks there. Otherwise, they could be like 0-12 at some point. Hour 2 up next. Don't go anywhere. It's Sharp Money.